Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, September 22nd, 2024. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator for this morning. The share ID numbers for Friday, September 20th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,762, that's 21762. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,763, that's 21763. This morning, A Vision for You presents countless vain attempts getting out of relapse. We come to this program of Overeaters Anonymous as a result of the suffering, the frustration, and the pain we experience compulsively overeating. We come to Overeaters Anonymous looking for a solution which will free us from the bondage of our affliction. Many of us, however, even within the rooms of OA, continue to experience the constant defeat, frustration, and pain of compulsive overeating and its relentless progression. We pick up that first bite again and again and again and again. As promised, our disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. OA stands for the proposition that the 12 steps give us freedom from the bondage of food. If the steps are not working for you, then perhaps you're not working the steps. The OA 12 steps, if practiced as a way of life, can and will expel the obsession to compulsively overeat and enable the sufferer to become happy, joyous, and free. The Big Book is a basic textbook that was written to answer three basic questions. What is the problem? What is the solution? What is the program of action necessary for me to find that solution? Joining us this morning to speak and elaborate on this topic of getting out of relapse is John Kay, a recovered compulsive overeater from Los Angeles. John is a recovered compulsive overeater, a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, and sincerely dedicated to living and carrying the message of recovery. Great appreciation and always a delight to welcome John Kay to the line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leah. Nice to be here again. Nice to hear your voice. Good morning, folks. Page 30 of the Big Book, it says, our countless drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts and to prove that we could drink like other people. And then later it says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. You know, when I think about Bill, I think about that sentence, this is the first step in recovery. You know, the word step in that sentence has a lowercase s. And the step one, with the capital S, speaks about admitting powerlessness, sort of as opposed to just conceding we were alcoholics or, you know, compulsive eaters in our case. It made me think about Bill, you know, and how I could sort of see three Bill W's. You know, Bill number one was the Bill that we all know from Bill's story, you know, first blissfully ignorant and then denying of his problems, even when everybody else could see it. We jump ahead to Bill number three, the sober Bill, you know, whose program saved my life. In the middle, though, was Bill number two. You know, this was the Bill that had come to realize the problem, but who still found himself beating on the bar, asking how it had happened again. You know, I think this is the stage that anyone with a continuing relapse problem finds themselves in. conceding to themselves that they have a problem, and yet still being unable to stop. You know, for me, this is place step zero, you know? Now, I know the common thinking is step zero is if you want what we have and are willing to go any lengths to get it. But look, for the sake of this talk and me not even wanting to get into fractions, so let's call it step zero. Now, I myself am the survivor of 14 years of abstinence. And in those years of relapse, it happened, somebody going to 4 to 5 meetings a week, someone who had a sponsor, was an intergroup rep, was even leading meetings and being a sponsor, you know, nothing that I should have been doing. Now, I could quote you large portions of the big book. I knew loads about philosophy and psychology, and still, I couldn't get out of the food. You know, I was a perfect example of knowledge of our disease alone will not cure us. Now, I was stuck at that step zero, you know, knowing I had a problem, but seemingly incapable of moving past that to find long-term abstinence. Now, luckily, 28 years later, I was gifted 28 years ago with my current abstinence, and it's reinforced in me that the 12 steps are definitely the key to long-term abstinence. Now, if you've ever heard any of my previous special editions, you know I talk about the wisdom of the big book and the steps a lot, and I talk about my higher power and my ongoing relationship with it. And, you know, I could not have had my current abstinence without a higher power, but how that help was given to me is some of what I'm going to talk about today. You know, I'm going to talk more real-world things today concerning relapse. You know, this is for people who are still in relapse, or perhaps people who know and care about someone who's in relapse, or, you know, even just somebody who wants to stay out of relapse. I want to talk about those who haven't been able to get to step one, and that they are, like I was, stuck at step zero. You know, these are people who have prayed to their higher power for abstinence and guidance. They've dug in and participated in meetings every day. You know, they've studied the big book. They've given service. They've heard put the food down over and over in program. And it's not that they don't want to. They just haven't been able to do it. So this might be a little unorthodox for a special edition, but I have a reason. See, all of my relapse workshops have involved looking at the mindset of a person in relapse, how to use the steps on relapse, avoid relapse, etc. You know, I've even written a book on it. And yet, I am haunted by something. At the end of my relapse workshops at both of the last Vision for You conventions, people came up and sometimes they're frustrated to tears and say, and said to me, you know, all this is fine and good, but how do I do it? How do I get out of my relapse? You know, how do I stop? And, you know, I've been thinking about those people ever since, you know, almost 5 years now. And some of what I'm going to talk to you about today will hopefully help those people who are in that prison of step zero. Now, stopping the relapse in its tracks is, of course, the most important thing to deal with first. You know, experts agree that trying to work the steps while continuing to self-medicate is a waste of time for all concerned. You know, Dr. Silkworth broke new ground when he identified the twofold nature of the disease, you know, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, or as he liked to call it, the phenomenon of craving. However, for the most part, 12-step programs of all kinds are working on the obsession of the mind, because it's assumed the user has already stopped that allergy of the body, at least temporarily. However, for those in relapse, this isn't the case. You know, one important thing, the concept of relapse is often seen as an ongoing activity. The truth, however, is that it involves many relapses. You know, there's an important distinction. Those in relapse lost somewhere along the way, and it's this important fact. We all wake up abstinent every morning. You know, I would talk about being in relapse, but in actuality, I was starting a new relapse every day. You know, we have to take the active step of eating things that aren't on our food plan or amounts greater than we should. And this requires a decision on our part, although for those in longer relapse, that decision may have been made a long time ago, followed by resignation of being hopeless when it came to the food. And when hope is lost during a relapse, that, you know, should I or shouldn't I discussion at the moment of that first compulsive bite becomes, you know, almost irrelevant. You know, that decision was made by my relapsing self as a blanket decision at some time in the past and was acted on every day as if that decision had become immutable. But it wasn't, and it isn't. Now, it's my belief that my abstinence is a gift. I can't get abstinent. I can only stay abstinent. Now, the gift for me was getting help from some power greater than myself during those early days of my current abstinence. Something helped me hang on by my fingernails in the beginning instead of reverting back into the food after a few days like I had done every week for years. Well, what was the difference? You know, I don't know exactly. And to me, the closest word and concept I can come up with is grace. You know, I joked that my higher power looked down at me and said, okay, he's had enough. And by the way, if you hear me say, and a thought came into my head, I don't think it was me. I think it was my higher power. Now, while this gift helps me stay abstinent, there's only one person who can give it away, and that's me. You know, no higher power ever came down and ripped abstinence away from somebody, especially someone working hard on their recovery and working the steps. Now, my job, especially in the beginning, was to work to put as many impediments as I needed to between me and that first compulsive bite. You know, I realized I had a gift and that doing that work was my side of the bargain. You know, my thank you for that gift. You know, it was essentially surrender. Now, a quick background on me for some context. I'm the child of two alcoholics who taught me one bad lesson. That's, if I don't like how I'm feeling inside, there's something outside I can put inside of me to make me feel better. And from an early age, that was food. And I grew up as a fat kid and all the abuse that came with that. And I didn't want to be fat, you know, so I tried everything. I was in Weight Watchers at 13, you know, I tried every diet in the world. And while I used to say that none of them worked, the reality is all of them worked once. You see, I'm a good little student and I'll follow your syllabus for a while, but I have the brain of a compulsive eater. So sooner or later, I'd find loopholes and then be gone. Well, after high school, I found alcohol. For the first time in my life, I was able to lose weight. I got to a normal weight, you know, for about 10 seconds. I had my first girlfriend, but then the alcohol took over, and I became a full-blown alcoholic. You know, the joke I say is that I just inherited the family business. So as a result of my drinking, I lost the girlfriend, and I lost the will to continue eating the way I was when I was skinny. And as a result, the weight came back on, and then some got me up to the highest weight of my life. You know, the history of my life up until then was that A, I was fat, then B, I was a drunk, and then C, I was a fat drunk. Now, I knew about AA from my mother, but I wanted nothing to do with it because, to me at that time, it was filled with religious nuts. Now, the moment to save my life came after a Sunday morning meeting where an old-timer convinced me that I could stay in AA till I was 100 years old. No one was ever going to tell me I had to believe anything about a higher power. But then he added, just try to keep an open mind. And to me, that was my first spiritual awakening and where I was ready to get better. You know, it was my first introduction to the big book and the steps, and it was impressed on me that recovery depended on me not seeing program as a social club, but rather as a school of higher education. And then, in my sobriety, I got back into the crazy dieting I was doing to lose the weight I had gained, and that caused me to relapse in alcohol. And when I came back, I knew I had only been dealing with one aspect of a multi-headed monster. You know, because by then I had heard about OA, I knew I needed to go, and had been avoiding it. But now, after that relapse, the line from Freedom from Bondage rang true for me, where she says, I realized I had to get rid of it, for my reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. Well, the it for me was compulsive eating. So I found my way to OA, and all of a sudden, everything made sense. You know, why was I gifted a brain that worked so well with so many areas of my life, except food and alcohol? Because I had a disease, and I needed a power greater than myself to help me with my problem. Well, I fell in love with OA. I got the food plan suggested, and I lost all of my weight in a relatively short time. You know, I couldn't understand why all the rest of you were having a problem. This is so easy. Well, fast forward to about a year later, my sponsor left program, and I felt I didn't need another one because I had the answer. It was meetings and the food plan. Yeah, the big book and the steps were there, but they were of minor interest to me. And then it all fell apart. I gave away my abstinence and couldn't get it back. I was like Bill, beating on the bar, asking myself, how would it happen? You know, and in trying to get that abstinence back again, I was doing everything I had been doing on my first abstinence, but nothing was working. You know, it took a while, but then a voice inside my head said one day, maybe you weren't doing it right the first time. And you know, that voice was right. You see, I think I lived a classic OA story. I got an easy early abstinence and gave it away because, of course, if it was easy the first time, of course it'll be easy the next. But it was not. You know, and it didn't hit me until years later about why it had worked the first time. Because it was just another one of those diets that worked for me once. Now I had to pay more attention to the big book and the steps and do the work. Well, I got some abstinence from time to time. I found myself a great group in Darien, Connecticut, where I was living. And then I went to L.A., and my program fell apart. I couldn't string more than a couple of days, a couple of weeks together before going out again. And as I said in the beginning, I was in program for a long time. I was doing everything I thought I should be doing. I was going to 4 to 5 meetings a week, having a sponsor, being a delegate to the inner group, sponsoring and leading a meeting. But, you know, I would leave that meeting and stop at the donut shop on the way home. And I remember walking out of that donut shop one day and saying to myself, what are you doing? I'm not sentenced to OA. If I don't want to be there, I don't have to be. But, you know, that's that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization spoken about and more about alcoholism. Anyway, fast forward a few years until I was given the gift of abstinence I have today. And, you know, since then, I dedicated myself to helping those in relapse, because I remember that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I remember the hopelessness and the shame I felt while I watched people around me get long-term abstinence when I couldn't. But enough about me, though. Let's talk about some of the things I've learned and learned the hard way. You know, I've had two big revelations when it came to looking back at my relapsing career. One had to do with my misunderstanding of powerlessness, and the other had to do with my misunderstanding of the disease and how it works on me. Well, first about powerlessness. You know, I would say all the time I was powerless, and then I'd go out and eat. And then I'd come back, program, and swear I was powerless again, and go eat again, you know. And I repeated that behavior over and over. Well, you know, how powerless did I really think I was? You know, when I went out, was I saying, oh, the hell with OA, I'm leaving? No. What was in there was a thought that I couldn't even access at that time. And that thought was, when I'm done, I will come back and I will get abstinent again. Yeah, it's not exactly admitting powerlessness, right? Well, why did I think that? Because I had the empirical proof that I could. If you've ever been on that in-and-out cycle, you're proving to yourself, well, actually deluding yourself, into believing that you are powerful over the food. You know, during one of my last slips, I remember asking myself, why'd you do it again? You had 2 weeks. And suddenly a voice in my head said, nah, you broke your abstinence a long time ago. This is just another example of it. And it hit me. Yes, I am powerful over the food in the small picture. But in the big picture of life, I am totally powerless. You see, I've been on a years-long in-and-out cycle, and I had deluded myself into believing that some of those end times were abstinence. But they really weren't. It's like the difference with somebody who runs 300 yards and then sits down for a while, and then gets up and runs another 300 yards and sits down, and does that for 26.2 miles. Now compare that to running a marathon. And you know, that's the point. Abstinence is a marathon. It's about getting through everything life has to throw at you without bailing into the food as a pressure valve. You know, it can sometimes be painful. It can sometimes require a white-knuckle abstinence. You know, but as I tell sponsees, white-knuckle abstinence is definitely not the optimum kind. But if it's a choice between white-knuckle abstinence and eating, take the white-knuckle abstinence because it's finite. A relapse, though? Well, that could be the beginning of a years-long one like mine. Or, you know, a last relapse. So for me, I had to change that definition of powerlessness. Today, for me, it means that food can no longer be an option for being upset or angry or happy or any kind of emotion. You know, food is the fuel my higher power designed to power my body and mind. You know, my food can be enjoyable. It can even sometimes involve eating a little too much of things I know I can eat without triggering the obsession. But it can't be a salve for painful emotions. As I heard someone say once, if you're a compulsive eater and you've made food an option, it'll always be the only option. It'll always be the path of least resistance. You know, and it's true. You know, if it's a choice between feeling lousy or eating a food you like and that helps you feel better for a short time, well, you know, that choice seems like a no-brainer. But as they say, if it's not an option, it's not a problem. Now, the other big revelation I had involved my perception of the disease and how it works on me. Now, I always liken my disease to the world's best salesman. You know, if you've ever met a good salesman, they're likable and they're charming and they like their product and they know you like their product, you know, in this case, the food. Now, imagine that during a relapse, that salesman is there 24/7 trying to make the sale. Now imagine this is a salesman that can also read your mind so that anything you're going to say to keep that sale from being made, he's got a logical answer for. Why? You want to stay sober? No problem. Put the booze in a glass of milk. It'll be okay. But the most evil thing about that salesman is that if he made the sale, you know, got me to go eat like he did many times. He then put his arm around me and said, hey, don't forget, this was your idea. No, it wasn't. If I really wanted to eat, I wouldn't have been going to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I wouldn't have had a sponsor, been a delegate, all those things I was doing to keep that salesman at bay. And you know, it's the same as anyone who's listening today. You don't really want to relapse, or you wouldn't be listening. You know, I'm sure everybody here has something better to do on a Sunday morning than dialing in and listen to somebody talk about compulsive eating. But that's the thing. That's the face of addiction. Doing something you really don't want to be doing over and over. You know, I always say, you know, if only our disease sounded different in our heads. You know, let's say like Darth Vader, you know, John, go to 7-Eleven and be injured. I mean, then I could say, oh, wait, that's the voice of my disease. I shouldn't listen to that. So instead of listening to how it sounds, I need to listen to what it's saying. Anyway, that was the major change in my perception of the disease. I needed to see it as something outside myself that I needed to battle, not just me changing my mind for the 4,000th time. Now, it's a hard concept to wrap your head around, you know? It's so much easier if we're talking about something like cancer. You know, that's something you can see on an MRI. But think about it. People who have cancer are growing it in their bodies. It's not being injected into them. But we all understand that it's something foreign, something they don't want in their bodies. Well, you know, it gets harder when we talk about cognitive diseases. You know, there are parallels to addiction like epilepsy and schizophrenia. You know, you can't put somebody with either of those diseases in an MRI and show them, let's say, the epileptic part of the brain. But we know it exists by the presence of the symptoms. Now, the difference between that disease and ours is that no epileptic, after having a seizure, feels guilty about it. Now, the bottom line is we have a disease, but it's a treatable one, and we just have to take our medicine. You know, you're taking it right now. You take it every time you dial into Vision for You or attend a Big Book meeting or go to the OA birthday party. I needed to remember also that this is a cunning and baffling foe, and it'll use every weapon in its arsenal against me. I mean, it'll take every piece of information I know about program and the disease and use it against me. You know, to paraphrase Shakespeare, the disease can quote the Big Book for its purpose. You know, because I remember using excuses like, well, I won't beat myself up, or, oh, relapse is just part of recovery, or at least I'm not drinking, or, well, I'm not eating the way I did before I came to program. Little hint here, almost nobody eats the way they did before program. You know, that doesn't mean it's good. You know, I would talk about working on my spiritual side as a way to get abstinent, or work on the steps to get abstinent, or study the Big Book. You know, and there was always my famous, I'm redefining my abstinence, which really meant I was redefining my honesty. You know, my favorite excuse, though, was I'm praying for the willingness. You know, willingness isn't given. It comes from pain. But, you know, that's an example of the disease convincing me that I was doing something about it when all I was doing was talking about doing something about it. See, my disease got up every day with one job to do, and that was to get me to kick the can down the road another day on putting the food down. And it did that because it knew if it could do it today, it could probably do it again tomorrow. You know, I have workshops where I try to get people to examine the disease and how it works on them. Now, obviously, at its core, we all know our disease is a spiritual malady, which in turn can later, you know, lead to the physical aspect of eating. But what gets lost sometimes is the how the disease gets into us. It gets in through the emotional or mental component. You know, the spiritual aspect of our disease doesn't just jump right over that to physical. So the doorway to relapse lies in that emotional component. And that's why the Big Book doesn't just give advice and lessons on how to stay away from alcohol. You know, we eat over what's eating us. And so the steps help us clean out that attic to remove the things that were driving that engine of relapse. You know, also for me, getting therapy was part of my answer. You know, therapy in addition to program, not as an alternative, can be hugely beneficial. You know, the key, of course, is you also need to stay abstinent to get to the real problems. You know, as they say, if you want to figure out what you're eating over, stop eating. Now, in my case, what came out in therapy after a while was that I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in. And since I'm a child of alcoholic people pleaser, the thought of having to go express my desire to leave was so abhorrent that I kept wheeling this huge distraction of relapse between me and the real problem. And by the way, it all had a happy ending. My ex found a wonderful guy. I found a wonderful wife. The upshot of that story is that that buried problem was like an iceberg. What was sticking out above water for me was the eating, but the real problem was beneath it. You know, like they say, food isn't the problem, it's the solution. And I think for many people stuck in those relapse cycles, they have some kind of iceberg. You know, not necessarily like mine, but something that is so painful, either in the present or in the past, that they'd rather be killing themselves with the food than face it. You know, for some people, I know it was buried trauma, sometimes through physical abuse, sometimes through mental abuse, sometimes sexual abuse. And some people can't even get to the buried memory until the food is down. Now, of course, at the end of the day, it's still about putting down the food. But whatever we can do to make staying abstinent just a little easier, it's important. So the question that every relapser has to ask themselves is, am I ready? You know, one of the most difficult aspects of compulsive eating is that the pain it delivers is a dull, chronic pain. You know, it's the kind of pain that makes you realize you should do something about it, but often not enough to be willing to go to any lengths when dealing with it. And you know, if your answer to that first question is that I'm ready, then you have to stick with it, even if you fail at first. You know, I started a relapse workshop a few months back, and I had 20 plus members when I started. Slowly, however, that number dropped and dropped until one day last week I had only one person in the group. And to me, this is a metaphor to the problem people in relapse sometimes have, being willing to commit to their recovery and not expect immediate success. And if they don't get it, move on to something else. But, you know, the big book lays it out with no equivocation. Willing to go to any lengths with all the desperation of drowning men, and of course, half measures avail us nothing. Now, the trouble with half measures is that they can give the illusion of availing us more. And in the beginning, they may. But sooner or later, and my first abstinence was a perfect example of this, sooner or later, things all fall apart. And it isn't until after that collapse that you can look backwards and say, ah, I guess those half measures did avail me nothing. Now, another question to ask is, what are your expectations? You know, do you expect your higher power will just come down and take the cravings away? I mean, I did that for years. Now, what I needed to do, I realize now, was to pray for my higher power to just meet me halfway when I get the cravings, and give me the strength to deal with them. You know, I wanted a higher power to give me the abstinence that would make the road smooth and easy. I mean, because that's what I thought when I was trying to get that first abstinence back. Well, you know, in the drug and alcohol business, we talk about how drug addicts are always chasing the first high. That means they want the same effect now that they got the first time they used the drug. But that never happens. Well, in retrospect, I was chasing that first abstinence, you know, the one that was easy and didn't require any effort on my part. Now, that easy abstinence, if you're lucky to have gotten one, I think it only comes once. You know, in the months leading up to the first day of this current abstinence, I was slipping constantly. And I had a series of sponsors, you know, all wonderful, caring people who would quote me inspirational thoughts, but I kept going out. And then I got a sponsor. I remember his name was Ward. And he said to me, okay, you're in your first month of abstinence, and it's going to suck. Now, the reality was that most of the time it didn't suck. And when it didn't, I thought, wow, I'm ahead of the game. But when I did hit a day that sucked, I was able to say to myself, okay, this is just what Ward told me. The point is that expectations can make or break your early abstinence. Now, one of the things I like to stress when I do workshops is writing. Now, I know getting people to write is sometimes like pulling teeth, and it certainly was for me. But, you know, that story of the icebergs, mine and others, show an important aspect for many of us. We're out of touch with our feelings. You know, we're out of touch with our level of commitment and of our expectations. And putting this down and these thoughts down on paper can help me keep it real. And some of the things I ask people to write on are, am I willing to go to any lengths, even if it puts you in an uncomfortable situation with others? Am I ready to weather the emotional storms without that pressure valve I used for years? Am I realistic about my expectations surrounding early abstinence? And how much do I value abstinence? You know, the people who do best are those who can make abstinence the most important thing without exception. It's like they say on airplanes, put the mask over your own face first. Because if I'm not abstinent, sooner or later, the rest of my life will fall apart. Maybe not instantly, but remember that half measure story. Now, another good writing question is, what kind of action plan will I have? You know, the worst decisions I make are the spur of the moment ones. You know, one of the drawbacks of being a compulsive eater is that I sometimes have to plan more than someone without my problem. I have to think about the day ahead and how I'm going to take care of myself with the food. You know, I don't have the luxury of saying, oh, well, if I don't get something to eat, I'll just pop into Starbucks and get a muffin. And, you know, my disease was big on getting me to not plan so that I was, quote, forced to eat outside my food plan. You know, I think another important thing is to write about identifying your triggers. You know, everybody has triggers, but they're different for everyone. You know, sometimes these triggers can be upsetting events in our lives. Other times the trigger might be more banal. You're watching something on TV that shows something you used to binge on. And other times, especially in the beginning, it can just be dealing with the fact that things have changed. You know, I heard on a meeting recently a person say, I had just become acclimated to certain activities that I've been doing for many years. Now, for some, that might be eating in the evening while watching TV. For others, it's eating while driving. I mean, it's different for everyone. Now, another trigger is actual hunger. You know, I was able to identify something in myself that still comes up from time to time, and I call it hunger panic. I think this goes way back in my life, probably to pre-verbal times. And sometimes, when I get hungry, I don't just think, oh, I'm getting hungry, I've got to go get my abstinent meal together. Or, well, I'm a little hungry now, but I'll last until dinner. What comes up sometimes is more primal. It's a feeling like, oh, my God, if I do not eat right now, I'm going to die. And this would often cloud my judgment and lead to bad food choices, you know, if not an outright break of my abstinence. I mean, it was a big trigger for me. Yeah, but let's face it, most of us have first world hunger. And as I spoke about earlier, my disease will throw up every distraction it can to get me, even with what would seem like valid program concepts. You know, I tell newly abstinent people that it's their full-time job to stay abstinent for the first 30 days. You know, if you can work on other things like the steps and the big book, great. Just don't allow it to distract you from that full-time job of staying abstinent. You know, there's a great quote from the civil rights movement of my youth, keep your eyes on the prize. Now, I think it's important for people to sit down and write about why they want to get and stay abstinent. I know that seems silly on the surface, but there's almost always a lot more to it than, you know, I want to get to a size 10. To me, this is about your values. You know, what do you want out of life? Is the food moving you toward that or away from that? You know, people should write on that and then keep it and read it from time to time. It's important to remind ourselves about our values and our motivation. because our disease can often do a mind wipe, so we forget all this. Now, another thing I talk about is acceptance. Now, we've all read Dr. Paul's story, at least I hope you have, and we're working on overall acceptance. But what I'm talking about here is acceptance that we have a disease and that we will have cravings. You know, in my experience, almost every newly sober or abstinent person, no matter how pink of a pink cloud they may find themselves on in the present moment, will find her or himself face to face with a craving or cravings at some time in the future. And understanding and accepting that this phenomenon will happen at some future point can make it easier to be ready for it. You know, let's say you've been doing well in your newfound abstinence. Things have been easy, and then it hits. You know, maybe it starts as a passing thought about something you used to eat, and it's accompanied by fond memories about that food. Well, this is called euphoric recall in my business. You know, the thoughts now come more and more, and there's a point where you're actively considering breaking your abstinence. What happens next is that acceptance that you're having a craving. Acceptance doesn't mean you fight it. It doesn't mean you try and push it out of your brain. It doesn't mean you beat yourself up for having it. You have a disease, and you happen to be experiencing one of the symptoms. You know, having a craving is not the problem. The way we deal with the craving can either be useful or become the problem. You know, the important thing that I don't think is ever said enough is that staying abstinent, at least in the beginning, is hard. You know, it's not hard every day, and the more time you get under your belt, those bad days become less and less frequent, but they can still come. The message I try to impart to people in their early days is that it gets easier. If my day-to-day abstinence today was as difficult as my first month, I wouldn't stay at it. I'm not a masochist. But the thing to understand is to get to the place where it's easy, you got to go through the place where it's hard first. And, you know, understanding and accepting that this is the arc of recovery can help be prepared for the way ahead. And another thing that makes it hard for people who've been in a relapse cycle is that you lose hope. You know, part of you is working hard and desperately wants it to stick this time. But there's a small part of you that's thinking, okay, I know where this is going. It's only a matter of time before I get back into it. Well, you know what? This is a natural and actually logical assumption. If the only evidence you have is that eventually you're going to fail again, it's hard to have the hope that this time things will be different. But there's a truism I love. I heard a person say once, in the history of the world, with everything that works, there was a time when it didn't work first. You know, Edison took years to perfect a light bulb. You know, there are many of us in OA who didn't just get hit on the head with the wand from the abstinence fairy. You know, we didn't come in for a three-point landing. We bounced a lot before the wheels grabbed. You know, the sad fact is that you don't get the proof that you can have long-term abstinence until you get long-term abstinence. But you can't get abstinent outside the rooms. And that's why you always hear keep coming back. But I also add to it, but do it. Because my abstinence can use keep coming back the way I used I'm praying for the willingness, you know, as a way to stay in the food and delude myself into thinking that I'm actually doing something about it. You know, an important key with dealing with cravings is to remember you have the disease and you are not the disease. You know, the beginning of the triggering process is where the concept of an observing self can come in. This involves a shift in looking at your thoughts rather than from your thoughts. You know, I'll ask clients, what are your thoughts telling you? Instead of, what are you thinking? Now, that's a subtle difference, but it's an important one. It's about changing the viewing point from which these thoughts are seen. You know, during my relapse, the time between when I thought about breaking my abstinence and actually doing it, I mean, it could be instantaneous. Instead, if you can identify a food thought and be the observing self and think to yourself, huh, I'm having an urge to go eat and break my abstinence now. I wonder what that's about. You know, the ability to do this, to defuse that thought from an immediate action is important. You know, it might remind you that you have a disease and that that thought you're having is not coming from your higher self within you that wants to stay abstinent. You know, the self, your higher power wants you to be. You know, I urge people then to make a phone call or a text either to a sponsor or a friend in program. You know, I always say that the key to spirituality and program for me is its grounded out nature. As in God, myself, another human being. And I need that because I can't always tell what's the voice of my higher power versus the voice of my disease, just doing a really good impression of my higher power. And I think it's important to reach out because God speaks through people. And try and take a few minutes to consider out what's going on in your head. You know, a short time ago, you were committed to abstinence and there wasn't a food thought in your head. Now, you know, you got one foot out the door. What happened? You know, the reality is that if a thought of slipping comes to you, there's a really good chance that the food you want to go binge on is not within arm's reach. You're going to have to get up and either walk to the kitchen or out the door to get it. This means there will be a small space between the thought and the action. You know, what I'm talking about is trying to break yourself out of what I call zombie mode. You know, that knee-jerk reaction to a craving, like you're a puppet on a string. Now, in the big book, this would be akin to Fred's story and more about alcoholism. You know, in other words, that strange mental blank spot. Well, hopefully you've worked out an action plan that first involves calling or texting a sponsor or friends. Good. But what if they're not available? Well, we have so many more possibilities these days. There are Zoom meetings around the clock. If your craving hits in the middle of the night in Iowa and you don't want to wake anybody, well, there's probably a meeting starting in London or Dublin right now. And remember, there's still a power greater than yourself you can call on for help, and that he, she, it speaks through people. You know, for me, that last fork in the road happened on the first Thursday of my current abstinence. You know, I had started on a Monday and never made it past Thursday for months. On that Thursday night, however, when the cravings hit, the thought came to me. Okay, John, if you want to eat, you can eat, but not until after tomorrow morning's abstinent breakfast. I then picked up the phone and made a call. And I truly believe that act of giving myself permission to go eat later broke the spell. And I've been abstinent ever since. You know, that thought, again, you know, is it God or is it God? What I didn't know then was something I learned when I went back to school to study addiction, and that's that the average craving lasts 20 minutes. If I can deal with it, you know, it's called urge surfing, I've got a good shot of weathering the storm and that craving will go away. I never knew that because I never tried anything different, you know, other than eating. But how about the worst case scenario? You still go out and eat, take that first compulsive bite. Well, at least the thinking, reasoning you, you know, the real you that doesn't want to overeat, can come back later and examine what happened. You know, I urge people to sit down, even if they've given in, and do some writing and examination about what happened after the fact. Now, the key here is this: no self-recrimination. You know, who's going to want to write something if they think it involves sitting down and writing, I'm a failure again? No, you write this as if you're a reporter on a crime scene. You're interviewing the victim, which you are, and you're trying to trace the sequence. Then take a moment to have a conversation with a witness to that crime, your higher power. Take some time to meditate, especially on what happened. Can you believe that your higher power wants to help? Can you believe that it wants to love you till you can love yourself? And maybe it can help you see exactly how that disease preys on you, how that salesman keeps making the sale. You know, what did he say? What could be different? You know, so what good is doing this writing? Well, it can help you see how the disease is attacking you and hopefully get you to see it as an enemy from without rather than from within. Again, you have a disease, but you're not the disease. The disease is the disease. Now, don't misunderstand an important thing. You know, it says in the big book, the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. However, knowledge and action can give a different perspective when you hit that fork in the road and you're facing that first compulsive bite. You know, abstinence is hard enough, and anything we can do to make it a little easier, especially in the beginning, is critical. Now, remember, abstinence is a marathon, you know, and none of us, you know, possess some special abstinence gene or abstinence gland that others don't. Well, how do they do it? Through the 12 steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, here's a thought. Unless you're pushing food into your mouth right now and you're listening to me, you're abstinent. And all the people I know who have 20, 30, 40 years of abstinence have one thing in common. None of them started on tomorrow. They didn't even start on it today. They started now, right now. And everyone who's listening to this is abstinent right now. And as I said before, none of us are sentenced to OA. We all have the option of breaking our abstinence at any time moving forward. But we won't. Not because we can't, but because we choose to live life the way we were meant to live it. You know, remember, nobody comes out of the womb as an active compulsive eater. You know, some of us may have a genetic predisposition to it, but plenty of people who have that same predisposition don't end up needing OA. The one thing many of us have acquired is the belief that our label in life is compulsive eater. You know, for many of us, it's become our identity. We're not compulsive eaters. We're human beings who happen to have the disease, the affliction of compulsive eating. And it's a chronic condition we arrest one day at a time, but it does not define us. And, you know, the more we work on the steps, the more we can accept our humanness, and we can even begin to like ourselves. And, you know, someone who likes themselves doesn't want to do things that they know are deliberately self-destructive, like compulsive eating. But remember, getting and staying abstinent isn't getting to the finish line. It's getting to the starting line. Being at step one then requires one thing. You cannot delay in moving forward with your steps and working the program from here because, again, long-term abstinence isn't about stopping. It's about staying stopped. You know, for me, I needed my higher power to help me stay abstinent, not get abstinent. Now, to continue staying stopped, you need a life and a way of living that's working toward that end, not against it. And for me, that way was getting into the steps, and it was working the steps over and over and staying involved in a 12-step program. You know, the steps aren't a rite of passage, but rather a way of life. Why did I choose that way? Because people I knew and trusted told me that this was the way to a life without addiction and one where I could be happy, joyous, and free while living that life. Anyway, I know that this is a different special edition than usual and probably not one most people were expecting. But again, if you were one of those people who came up to me at the convention 5 years ago and asked, how do I stop? I hope this helped. Thanks for letting me share.
Oh, John, excellent. Thank you so much for this fabulously thorough presentation full of your personal experience and insights, chock full of specific examples. Thank you so much. This will certainly be helpful to many and a gem for our archive. The share ID for today's presentation, 21,764. John's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so please stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can press star one. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name, and a reminder, questions only, please.
Veronica.
Veronica.
Freya H.
Riska R. Baltimore.
Freya H. Riska R.
Dana P.
Dana P.
Terry M.
Terry M.
Ruvain H.
Ruvain H. Thus far,
Diana
I have a
Y.
I'm sorry, who was that?
With Diana y? Y.
Diana Y. Okay, this is a good list. We have Veronica. I need the first letter of your last name, please. Freya H. Rifka R. Dana P. Terry M. Ruvain H. And Diana Y. Okay, let's get started with Veronica, please. Veronica, star one to unmute your question, please.
Okay, sorry about that. John, Veronica C. here from New York. Thank you so much for that presentation. And what I would like to ask you is, I absolutely loved, I typically don't use a lot of questions, but I really liked the different questions that you would ask people. Would you mind repeating those?
Oh, gosh, there was quite a few of them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'll tell you what. If you hang on, I will give my contact information. And if you send me a thing, I'll pull that together. I actually have a little, like, a reading thing I can give you. And we're also, by the way, it's Getting Ready, I was talking to Nancy J about we're going to start a new meeting, a relapse meeting on Sunday mornings. And so if you're interested, anybody who's interested, you know, when we get to the end, I'll give you my contact information and let me know if you'd like to be part of it. But yeah, I mean, I can't think of all of them on the spot. You know, again, the number one is, are you ready? You know, because a lot of us, oh yeah, I'm ready. But we sit down and say, okay, am I ready? What's involved with that? You know, and then see.
Thank you, Veronica, for your question. Freya H., your turn.
Good morning. This is Freya H. in Colorado. Thank you so much, John, for sharing your wealth of experience. And I feel like this is the million-dollar question of how can I best support somebody who is struggling with relapse or continued slips, whatever you want to call it. How can I best support them? Or are there any things that are not helpful, such as maybe sending them back to step one again and again? Any thoughts you have? Thank you.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. You know, I had gone over to another program for a while that was very strict, and if you had a break, you had to stand up at the meeting, and I broke my abs. I always just thought that was a bit shaming, you know. And if we believe this is a disease, you know, it's not involving something that should involve shame. It's weird. I've had, this is another one of those questions about, and I'll paraphrase one, you know, do you, if you're a sponsor, do you drop somebody who's been slipping a lot? I tend to not want to do that, but at a certain point, if I've thought of everything I can, I may say, hey, maybe I'm not the right sponsor for you. I'll hold on, but maybe this isn't clicking. Maybe I don't say things in a way that you can hear them right. But I just think some of it is trying to get people, you know, in other words, for example, I have, you know, because I did relapse workshop a long time ago here, and then I've done loads since, you know, I get people calling a lot, you know, sponsors. What do I do? Do I have them work on this step? Do I have them work on, you know, that, or, you know, what have, and again, I said what I was saying there earlier. I tell them, look, you know, the steps are the key, and the big book is the key, and all of the program stuff you've heard is the key. But my disease wants to throw up every distraction it can to keep me from holding on to my absence. So I say, you know, make it really important in the beginning, and maybe even, like I said, almost to the exclusion of the steps and everything, for 30 days, so that you start to get on a level where you can get into those steps. I don't think damning, I don't know how to put this. In other words, one of the greatest things that happened to me, believe it or not, was going to Al-Anon. And one of the things that happened to me with Al-Anon is I got my ego out of it. The last special edition I did, I was talking about how things have changed with me and my ego. I used to sort of, you know, have power struggles when I was young, newly absent with sponsees. Now I go, hey, you know, I'm here. This is what I do. You know, if you want this, this is what I do. And I try, I don't take it personally. And I, you know, I joke. And the one thing I want sponsees to do is to be honest, absolutely honest. And I tell them, look, if you have a relapse, I'm not going to gain a pound. The point being is there's a healthy, you know, what you could call clinical objectivity in my business, that I don't take it on, and I let them know I'm not going to judge them, but look, see if you can look at what's going on. And like I said, it's a two-pronged thing. Obviously, you know, what helped me get the long-term abstinence was, A, I had to attack my disease from the symptom direction. In other words, I had to put the food down. But B, I had to attack it from what for me was therapy direction, to find out why I was continuing to relapse and relapse. I felt like I was fighting myself and I couldn't understand it. And so I, you know, trying to get them to look at some of the things that are going beneath the surface a lot of times can help. So, and I don't know. That's what I can think of. Maybe send them to this talk. I hope that helps.
Great ideas. Thank you. Thanks for the question, Freya H. Rivka R., your turn.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much, Leah, for your service. And John, thank you so much for such a rich and great presentation. So one of the things that you said was that that person deludes themselves by saying, I'm redefining my abstinence. Actually, I have two questions. That's the first one, is that since there's so many ways to define abstinence, how do you go about defining yours? Because it's just exactly what your sponsor does or what the nutritionist says. And the second part is that you mentioned something about eating a little more when it's not emotionally caused, like that, if you could explain what you mean by that. Not being a break in abstinence.
Sure.
That's what I heard. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, you heard it right. Okay, well, first of all, I would constantly keep playing games with the abstinence. I always said it was like, I kept drilling holes in the lifeboat I was in, you know? And the reason was that this way I could tell myself I wasn't breaking my abstinence because I'm in the boat, but it's now at water level. Instead of just realizing, okay, I got pitched out of the boat and I need to climb back in. I know my old sponsor used to say, we can look at your abstinence, but we can only do it every 30 days. Because I started playing the amazing moving abstinence game, and my abstinence was pretty much whatever I did last night, you know. And again, that's about diluting. I'm a huge believer, by the way, in going to a professional nutritionist and trying to get help, because I don't have those letters after my name about attrition, you know, and it there's nothing wrong with that. And in terms of eating, I went to another program that had such a strict thing, such a razor's edge, that it became an authority figure for me, you know. I always tell the story that the program I was in had this, they almost had like a mantra. We eat three meals in, you know, what is it, 3 meals a day, nothing in between except diet, soda, sugar, sugar-free gum. And I did that, and I got what they promised me, but after a while, it became an authority figure I was rebelling against. And so I ended up coming back to OA, and there was a guy here named Ray. He's like 95 now, I think. He's still around, doesn't come to meetings, but he's got to have 50 years now. And Ray would get up and say, my abstinence today is I eat whatever I want, whenever I want, as much as I want, if I'm willing to pay the price. And today I am not willing to pay the price. So I eat three weighed and measured meals, nothing in between except diet soda, sugar-free gum. In other words, he says the same thing that they said. But the difference is Ray is working Ray's food plan. He's taking ownership of it. You know, I tell sponsees all the time, there's one word they are forbidden to use, and that's the word can't. I can't eat sugar. I can't eat white flour. I can't eat whatever. Sure you can. You know, this is America. You know, nobody's more than a few minutes from their binge food if they really want to. You know, using the word can't goes into your psyche and becomes an authority figure. You know, and that's another way my salesman started whispering in my ear. You know, my disease wants to desperately convince me that abstinence is deprivation. And it's just the opposite. You know, how many things did we deprive ourselves over the years because that salesman became our puppeteer? And the one other thing that I advise, and everybody's sponsor's different, so I'm not telling anybody what to do, is I said a good sponsor is like a baseball team manager. You know, some baseball teams are just championship teams. They're great. They know what they're doing. And that manager takes a very light touch with them. And other teams are, you know, just lazy and the manager needs to have them doing drills and everything. For me, all humans are different. And I can't have a cookie cutter way of being a sponsor, you know. And I don't think my abstinence is your abstinence. You know, that line I've always heard, your abstinence can kill me and my abstinence can kill you. We all have to find out the food plan that's going to work for us. And the only thing I say is it has to be honest. You have to find a way of talking to people you trust, you know, to make sure what you're doing is right. But I'm not a big fan of sponsees saying, here's how I eat, and this is the way you have to eat. You know, the bottom line, and I remember when I spoke on the first step at the last convention, and the one applause line I got was, I said, hey, you know, we're in Overeaters Anonymous. It's not sugar anonymous. It's not white flour anonymous. It's not artificial sweetener anonymous. It's Overeaters Anonymous. And we all are different. You know, I have a wonderful friend, Roberta, and she eats all foods moderately, you know, and God bless her, wish I could, right? But I also know she's not lying, you know? But I also think our disease is such, you know, in alcohol and drugs, it's really simple. You're doing it or you're not. But I believe our disease has different levels. And for me, my disease hit the level that I can't eat whole foods moderately, and I had to come to some kind of peace about that, because I would be at meetings and hear people talking about eating this or that, and hitting me is like, well, if she gets to eat that, I want to eat that, you know, I want to, and you can, but don't expect the results. You have to take ownership of it. Anyway, I don't know if that helps. I might babble on sometimes in the wrong direction.
Thank you, Rivka R., for your question. Appreciate that. Dana P., your turn.
Good morning, Dana P. in California. Thank you, Leah, so much for leading the meeting today. And John, thank you. I'll be listening to this one again. My question, and you know, I could editorialize quite a bit, which I will resist, but that, you know, you're laughing. Yeah, I know. the idea about being a heretic, I've shared that about my own recovery quite often. And I love what you said about people, you know, we're all different. And I don't have an experience with, you know, relapse, however that is defined, because I think it's the same as abstinence, you know, it's defined different for different people. Anyway, my question goes back to the beginning of your talk where you shared about grace and your quote unquote abstinence grace and the easy way, if you will. And I'd just like to hear a little bit more. I know it doesn't really maybe sound like a question, but would the intersection between grace and self-effort, if you will, especially having to do with the obsession of the mind, because for me, in the beginning of my recovery from compulsive overeating and purge vomiting, was a lot of paying attention to those thoughts and telling them no and in very forceful sort of way. And then at some point, I don't know when that happened, but there was the grace that came. And it's the obsession is lifted. It's been over 4 years. And I seriously believe that the higher powers got me, however that is. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and how the higher power, I never heard you say the word God, but how the higher power, that personal relationship is for you in your life. Thanks so much, and I'll pass.
Sure, sure. The last thing first, I always say higher power just because whenever I give talks, I try to keep it to the least common denominator. You know, the one time I didn't was when I did one of the special editions about defining a higher power, and then I did use God. It was still hard. I had a lot of, you know, Catholic school trauma about that word, and it took me a long time to realize it means something different for everybody. And I laughed about editorializing because I do that all the time, so I'm not making fun of you. Well, one of the things that I talk about, and I think one of the upshots I wanted people to really get here, is I hear so much in program about praying to God, and I think people mean that then doesn't require any effort, that eventually God will grant me the grace and it'll just come. And I don't believe that's how my higher power worked. I believe my higher powers, you know, said, you know, like pray to God and row to shore. I have my job to do in this. Now, I can't do it by will alone, or I would have done it the first day I was trying to get started on a Monday. But I think it's my job to keep trying and to keep doing whatever I can and to remember that. And I think part of this is also getting a mindset on how, you know, like I was saying, you know, abstinence is the most important thing without exception, and it involves me making that a priority. Now, can you say, oh, I'm using self-will or something like that? I mean, I guess, you know, but what, you know, what's helped me, and maybe this is what helped you too, is if you keep being willing to go to any lengths, I think at some point your disease gets tired and says, okay, I'm going to quit doing the cravings thing because he's only going to pick up the phone and call somebody. You know, the way I describe it sometimes, I say it's like the idea of a commitment to abstinence is like imagine you're walking down a street and there's 100 bakeries, one after the other. And you go to the first one, you open the door, you look in, you smell things, you look at everything and say, no, I'm abstinent, I'm not doing that. And you go to the second one and you do the same thing and you look at this stuff, no, I don't do that anymore. And you do that three and four. And by the time you get to the 99th one, you're like, well, you know, I've been doing so well. And that's where it gets hard. But what happens is after a while, if you keep working program, you walk down that street and you don't even see the bakeries anymore, you know? That's why I tell people in the beginning, it's not easy, but it will become second nature for the most part. But I think I kept expecting grace to mean it would just be easy. And that's one of the reasons I think I really wanted to sort of, I don't want to say load, but I put a lot in this about the fact that, you know, this is your part in it, you know. You can't be, well, I'm doing self-will if I'm trying it all. You know, I'm waiting for my higher power to, you know, or I used to joke, the absence fairy hit me in the wand. I got to do my part, and I need to keep doing that. Now, I believe my higher power's got my back. I believe my higher power will meet me halfway. But it's like I always say, God is my partner. He's not my servant. And I need to know that I'm willing to do all these things. And I can see how some people can hear some of the things I said as being like self-will, but I think this is just a guide to how to meet God halfway. I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Dana, for your question. Next up, Sherry M.
Hi, this is Sherry M. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, John. Appreciate you. My question is, you talked about God and the disease and that small space between the thought and the action, a.k.a. Fred's strange mental blank spot. I've been there, too. You talked about, you know, not being able to get through the first week, and then it's Thursday and you made the phone call, and the average craving lasting 20 minutes. What did, when you called that other person and you talked to them and then you've been abstinent ever since, what did they say to you? Was it like God speaking, or was it just the thing you needed to hear?
Well, you know, I don't remember what they say, and I almost didn't think what they said wasn't the most important thing. It was me picking up the phone and saying, I need help.
Mm.
I hadn't done that. I think my ego wants more. And I have to remember that this stuff doesn't go away. It gets a lot less. But I've had times, not recently, but with many years of abstinence where the stuff hit the fan, and even though I'm an alcoholic and a food addict, my path of least resistance is always going to be the food. I'll always eat before I drink. And the thoughts came, and the difference is having a little of that positive reinforcement of seeing how it helped. I picked up the phone and called somebody, and just said, hey, man, I just had this has happened, and I want to eat, you know? And whatever this was, I'm sure, a perfectly valid thing. You know, I've had sponsees who call up after breaking an abstinence and say, well, I had this happen. This was this horrible thing that happened, and that's why I ate. Or this thing happened, and it was really bad, and that's why I ate. And I always say to them, no, you ate because you're a compulsive eater. I said, and these were often really valid things that had happened to them, bad. And I would say, well, when that bad thing happened, did the thought of placing a bet on a horse come to you? You know, and they like look at me like I'm nuts. And I go, no, you didn't have that because you're not a compulsive gambler. But I'll bet you there's a sponsor in GA who heard somebody say once, oh, this horrible thing happened, and that's why I put a bet on a horse.
We have to remember, again, you know, fruit's the solution. It's not the problem. And yeah, and I don't know if that helps, you know, in terms of, you know, the whole thing, or whether I missed the point. Let me know.
Thank you, Sherry M., for your question. Appreciate that. Ruvain H., your turn, followed by Diana Y., if we have time. Go ahead, Ruvain.
Okay, thank you so much, John, for everything. It was really wonderful, and identified with a lot. I have a double question, and it could be that I misunderstood the message and or something else. So in light of the big book saying, in terms of one of the stories, the person saying that I needed to, whatever language you use, I needed to grow in my spiritual experience. I needed to, and you probably know the phrase better than me. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the presentation, you used the word emotional and intellectual, and I was surprised that you didn't say emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. So was there a reason, or was it just you were trying to make a different point? Another instance that I am just question about is, you said about the partnership with higher power, which I'm in full agreement with, and you said that but there was a point when I was doing everything that I was supposed to do. So I wondered whether that might have not been, in terms of one of two possibilities. One is that oftentimes I think I was doing everything when there was something that I wasn't doing, and or that higher power wants me to learn something else, and this is a point of where it's not, it's a part, yes, it is me, and it's also higher power is just letting me know that there is something else that I want you to pick up. And then, yes, he's done enough. Your response. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruben. I will just give you the idea that
John, press star one.
That's weird. I got muted somehow. I don't understand. I wasn't touching the phone. Anyway, I was saying that I had readjusted my concept of a higher power. I grew up with a very dogmatic higher power and an idea. And I always say we all get a hand-me-down higher power. And I think the important thing is to find out what was going to work with me. I still think almost every religion and things like that have all the same basic things. It's just, you know, the various, you know, I don't know, rituals and things like that. But I really, somewhere along the way, and I know it was right in my first a couple of weeks probably of sobriety, I really got, now my higher power is a hands-on higher power, but it's a hands-on power that wants me to be doing the hands-on too. And I think sometimes and this was actually something I went through. Well, I need to work on being more spiritual. I'm working on spiritual. And I just kept slipping and slipping. And I think the point I was trying to make here, if there was one, you know, thesis sentence of this whole thing, it is that praying, absolutely, higher, believing, and this is a spiritual malady, absolutely, underline, 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 but I needed to see that the thing my high power did was give me the strength and, you know, have the wind at my back and push me to do the things I need to do. You know, it, again, you know, the higher power is not going to rip a piece of chocolate cake out of my hand as I'm eating it. And I think for a long time, my slipping and sliding was because I had a much more of a, you know, I don't, an idea that, that if I just got the right spiritual thing, things will happen. And, you know, one of the, one of my other special editions, I read this, there's a great pamphlet. It's an AA pamphlet called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy, the person who was reading it says that he believes that the real miracle that happens is the willingness to act, you know, and when I talk about emotional and intellectual, you know, that again, that was part of that middle one, you know, where we have a spiritual, a physical, emotional thing. I was really sort of concentrated on that. And I believe at the end of the day, this is spiritual because I now do live on it on more of a spiritual plane, and it has changed my life, you know. But in the beginning, I think my disease wanted me to stay thinking in this ethereal spiritual thing as a way to not, you know, get me to move forward and meeting into meeting my higher power halfway. And, you know, again, it's that, that thing that, that my disease will use perfectly good concepts. And yeah, I mean, I think we all need to grow spiritual, but I, to me, I don't think the real growth happens until you've got the food down and then you're getting into the steps and working on it. What I was really trying in this one, again, the, because those people at the convention were so, I did often speak on a different level, but these people needed help day to day. And that's what I'm hoping this one was about. It's about day to day. It isn't, believe me, it's not that I don't believe my higher power had everything to do with me getting abstinent. It's changed my life. I'm, you know, if you listen to the last one I did on ego, that was that my higher power did something and just changed my life because now, you know, again, that great line where, you know, there's a God and it ain't me. And so don't misunderstand when I don't spend as much time talking about spiritual, that that's not a huge part of it. But my disease would love it if I just spend a lot of time thinking about spiritual, because maybe it'll keep me from things I need to do, which is work on the food. So I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Ruvane, for the question this morning. Thanks to all who posed questions. And, of course, thank you, John. It's always a delight to spend time with you, and what an excellent presentation this morning. So very helpful. And I look forward to archiving that in our website. Again, the share ID for today, 21,764. That's 21,764 for this magnificent presentation this morning. And we're going to close now from page 164. Of course, you know that it's in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until